with our special guest, G. Edward Griffin, back on Coast to Coast. And we've got so many things to talk with him about. Of course, his book is called A Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. He's got a documentary called Offline, which is right about the topic we've been talking about for a couple of years now, and that is our power grid. And we'll tie that into that story that came out of the White House today that they may be preparing for catastrophic solar flares. So we're going to talk with him about that a little bit later on. By the way, his co-documentary producer will join us, Petrea Patrick, and we'll get it all together for you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. G. Edward Griffin is a writer, documentary film producer, many successful titles under his belt. Edward is listed in Who's Who in America as a very well-known because of that talent of researching really difficult topics. As a matter of fact, very few people deal with tackling the Federal Reserve. He did that in his book, Creature from Jekyll Island. He's been on our program a number of times. We're going to talk with him about a number of subjects today. He's with us for the full 3 hours. He's got a documentary out, which we'll talk with him about next hour with his co-producer. It's called Offline, and it's about everything we've been talking about on the power grid. But G. Edward, good to have you back. How are you, sir?
Well, thanks for inviting me back. Well, right now I'm doing fine. I mean, I'm a kind of an owl like you are.
Yeah.
So I'm all set.
You know, I was doing some further research into what we're going to talk about next half hour on the grid, which is so critical. But as I was doing it, I'm saying, this guy, you being the guy, what a varied background. I mean, you're into everything, the Federal Reserve, the cancer industry, geoengineering. And so that begs the question, who are you?
who am I? Yeah, I'm kind of schizophrenic. That's true. I touch a lot of topics. But, you know, that the question, who are you, reminds me of the, there was a TV show back in, I guess it was maybe the 70s. It was the Loretta Young Show, I think it was called. And she always had something very poignant. And I remember the one episode where there was a party going on, and they had a party game. And everybody gathered around the living room, and she started to ask people, who are you? And the deal was that you had to answer three times. And each time, and the first time was to be the most important. And the understanding was that we're different people. So she was trying to find out who people were. And in answering that question, everything got very serious and so forth. And I remembered that a lot when this question of who are you comes up. And if I were to play that party game today, I suppose that the most important thing for me to say is, oh, I'm a human being like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I have all those feelings and fears and anxieties and desires and all of that stuff. So that defines me probably more than anything. The second most important thing probably in my life is that I'm a father and a husband. I have a family to take care of and to cherish and to make life better for them in the future and listen to their problems and all that sort of thing. And then finally we get to the third thing, which is, I suppose, why I'm here, is I'm a writer and a researcher, and I have a kind of a crusader instinct. I get involved in all these different topics because I have this sense of wanting to right the wrong, you know, kind of like tilting at windmills.
Same
way. Kind of thing.
That's right.
Yeah, so that's what attracts me, and that's who I am. I'm all the three of those people, but I can't resist a story where I feel that the truth is being suppressed,
mm-hmm.
or that the good guys are the underdog. It just, I can't stay away from it.
How do you find those stories?
Oh, they find me, George, just like you, I suppose. I don't go looking for those stories, but I'm a voracious reader of late. I wasn't in school, but when I got out of school, I found that the books were interesting. But, you know, you can't read until you stumble across all kinds of stories. And then, of course, people know about me because they've read my book, and so they stumble across things, and they send me emails and letters, and they say, you should know about this. And, oops, there I go. I'm on another topic.
Well, you know, you are a very well-read, you're a great researcher, and I can't wait to get into some of these specific topics with you throughout the night as we talk about so many different things. Did you ever, when you wrote the book about the creature from Jekyll Island, about the Federal Reserve, and I had you on years ago to talk about that, did that ever cause a problem for you? I mean, did anybody try to get you because of that? I mean, I think it was one of the reasons they got Kennedy.
Well, nobody's ever tried to get me, and I, of course, considered that long ago when I began to take this path. I figured one of these days I'm going to say something and do something and irritate people pretty high up this this chain, and they're going to not like me. And I'm sure that's true, but I don't think it's I haven't done that much yet, so I have to keep trying. So far, no, I haven't had any direct threats or anything like that, but I keep expecting it, you know. Got to happen someday.
Well, you're what, 84 years old? You sound like you're 34 for granted.
Well, yep, that's true. I feel like I'm about 34, maybe a little younger than that.
Let's talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve System and the fact that some people think that the bubble that occurred in 2007, 2008 is going to occur again. As a matter of fact, I was talking with a friend of mine who's a lawyer in St. Louis, Edward, and he represents a lot of banks. I'm not going to mention his name then to protect him, but he said, you know what? Banks have been protected, but they're not lending the kind of money they should be lending to people. And, you know, we then talked about, you know, my views, his views about a bubble, another bubble. I think it's going to happen. And I'm not sure the Federal Reserve is going to come and bail people out this time. What do you think?
Well, of course, let's start with the bubble issue. We are in a bubble. In fact, we've never really been out of a bubble for quite a while. Every time the bubble bursts, as they say, it doesn't go completely all the way down. They're in there patching up the hole so fast and pumping more air into it. I mean, we like to look back to 2008 and say everything crashed. Well, it didn't really. It took a serious adjustment, but you know, if you understand what a bubble is, and I know that you and your listeners are well versed on this, but I think we need to redefine these words so we really know what we're talking about. Classically, the definition of a bubble is an asset class or a particular asset where people are paying a price for it that's way beyond what it's really worth, and they know that they're paying more than what it's worth. But the only reason they're doing it is because they're confident, because the prices have been going up, they're confident that there'll be some fool greater than they are who will come along and buy it from them at more than what they paid for it. It's sort of a game to see how many people will, you know, step up and pay even more than above the price than the previous person did. So everybody knows that the price is above the actual value of the asset, but they're just playing that speculation game that they can make a killing on it while the game is going on. So that's what a bubble really is, and they always, always come to an end when suddenly, and nobody knows what triggers it, but it's always something, and it goes like wildfire. Everybody almost overnight realizes that it's time to get out because everybody's wants out, and they're not going to continue to play the game anymore. So when everybody tries to cash in their chips, nobody wants to buy the chips, and that's when the prices really crash, and people lose their savings, and they lose their life's value at the end of the bubble. That's what a bubble is. There have been lots of them in history. There have been quite a few here in the U.S., and we're living through the biggest bubble of all history right now.
Well, we really are. There's no question about that. But if we have another one that bursts so soon after the last one, can we really rebound?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure that we really rebounded. It's like giving a drug addict another shot of heroin. Let's say that he's going into the DTs. He's got all kinds of crisis going on because the drug is killing him. And so they give him another shot of heroin. Did he rebound? Well, it may seem like he did, but actually he didn't, because he's just further down the tubes. And the next time he starts to get a physical reaction, he's probably going to die. So I don't think we ever rebounded, but we certainly masked the symptoms so that the pain was not so noticeable. And of course, let's translate that into specifics. That means that the Federal Reserve came along and started pumping a lot of newly created money into the economy and flooding it through, and a lot of people got hold of that easy money, and they were able to buy things again before the prices went up. And so that sensation of doing well is what sort of eased the pain, and people forgot that they're still in a bubble.
Yeah, they still are in a bubble. So with the documentary we're going to talk about the next half hour, and it is so dear to my heart, we've been pounding away at that. What else are you looking at these days? You're looking at the Cancer Institute and what's happening there?
Yeah, George, I'm always looking at that. That was one of my early topics. I became interested in alternative treatments for cancer back in the 1970s. And my book on that was called World Without Cancer. It was published in 1974. And it's been quite popular ever since. We update it and revise it, and it's still one of our best-selling books. And I've stayed very close to the topic. Unfortunately, not much has changed in that category. It's similar to the story on the Federal Reserve. Not much has changed there either. It's just gotten worse. And that's true in the world of cancer treatment and therapy. People are contracting cancer today at a rate higher than ever before, in spite of the fact that more and more money is being spent on supposedly being spent on a cure for cancer. And we have the war on cancer mentality everywhere you look. In spite of all that, people are still dying of cancer more than they ever did, and more people are contracting it, to the point where today just about one in every three people in all of the advanced countries of the world are going to contract cancer in their lifetime. One out of three. I mean, gosh, that's just incredible. You know, in another few years, it'd be one out of two, and then finally it's everybody. So, yeah, I've been following it closely, and it's something that I think is very parallel to the story of the Federal Reserve, in that we're dealing with a cartel. The Fed, of course, is a banking cartel that has obtained control over our economy, over our money system, and even beyond that, over our own government. Well, in the field of cancer, there is a cancer industry. It's the pharmaceutical industry is really the same cartel structure, except it's in the field of healthcare, and that has obtained control over the medical profession. And in both cases, this cartel dominance has been to the detriment of the people. It's enriching the members of the cartel, but it's causing just the opposite of what people think they're getting from the medical profession and what they think they're getting from the banking industry.
There are some solid researchers out there, I am sure, who would love to develop and find a cure for cancer. But I've always wondered, do they really want that cure? Because there's so much money pumped into, you know, the possibilities that once they find the cures, you don't need that money anymore, do you?
Well, that's always the dilemma, isn't it? When you take a look at the so-called nonprofit organizations that are doing all this cancer research, what happens to those thousands and thousands of people, and the executives and researchers are extremely well paid, what happens to these people if they should stumble across a cure for cancer?
Yes.
Well, they'd be out of work. They'd have to do something else. So you know they're not really highly motivated to find a control for cancer, or rather a cure for cancer. What they would like to find is something that's patentable, something that can cost a lot of money, that could maintain people in a state of cancer, so they'd be constantly having to take the medication just to stay alive, but they would never cure it. That's the golden calf that they all seek, is that maintenance of a disease rather than the cure of a disease. That's where the money comes from.
I always remember the former muscular dystrophy telethon with Jerry Lewis. And, you know, Jerry worked for years just not getting paid, donating his time, raising billions of dollars for MD to find a cure. They never have yet. At least we don't know if they have. And, I mean, I looked at that and said, all these years, all these billions of dollars, but if they find a cure, you don't need these telethons anymore. They all go away.
Well, they won't go away because they're not going to find a cure. That's really not what they're looking for. But that's what they tell you they're looking for.
Some want to find a cure, I think. Don't you think?
Well, no. I
really?
Have to be honest about that. Once they get involved in that cartel that I'm talking about, once they realize that their very livelihood, the future and well-being of their family depends upon them researching and searching for a cure, no, they don't want to find a cure. Wow. Not really at the level that you and I would. They might like, in fact, let me give you an example.
All right.
When Leah Trill, which was one of the topics that I wrote about, and I found out a lot about Leah Trill as an alternative treatment.
That's from the apricot seed, right?
It comes from apricot seeds and many other sources as well, but it's the apricot seed is its primary source. Very controversial back in the 70s, and in fact, my book had a certain role to play in putting that into the controversy. But anyway, it was tested by Sloan Kettering Laboratories back in the 70s. And the idea was that there were so many people reporting being cured by taking Leah Trill, and they were forming into organizations, some of which I had some role in forming, little grassroots organizations, and they were showing film strips that we produced and distributing literature and telling everybody, saying, hey, look, we've got the solution. Come, let us tell you about it. And these former patients who were told they had, you know, 3 months to live or 3 weeks to live, here they were by the thousands testifying before various state legislative committees, saying, let's legalize Leah Trill because here I am alive 2-3 years later, and I was supposed to be dead in 3 weeks, but when I started this, and these were people were everywhere, so it became kind of embarrassing to the pharmaceutical cartel that here we had something that was basically free. It grows on a tree, huh. And it was curing cancer, and it was already cutting into the very expensive chemotherapy regimens that were being used. So they had to do something to squelch that. And so they said, look, here's what we'll do. We'll have one of the great prestigious institutions in the land do objective research on it. We'll have Sloan Kettering in New York. We'll have their scientists take a look at this thing called Leah Trill, and we'll prove once and for all, is it effective or not? And then we can put this thing to rest. Well, everybody thought that was a great idea, except they didn't realize how, you know, how stacked and rigged the deck was. So they went to Sloan Kettering. They didn't realize that there were a couple of people on the board of directors that represented the pharmaceutical industry, of course, and would never let Sloan Kettering do anything that would demonstrate the effectiveness of a treatment for cancer that would cut into the sales of the pharmaceutical industry. Never. Anyway, they pretended as though they were going to do that, and so they turned the research over to the head of their research department. His name was Dr. Kinematsu Segura.
Right.
He was a Japanese fellow, and he was an older gentleman. He was very well respected. Everybody knew Kinematsu Segura, and they said, he'll do the job. Well, make a long story short, after the trials, these were studies on mice, after these trials were started, about 3 or 4 weeks into the experiment, Segura let it be known that he was getting tremendously positive results. In fact, he even submitted a letter in which he said, I have never in all my life seen anything quite so effective on these mice as this thing called Leah Trill. Well, that's not what the board of directors was looking for. So they took Segura off the job. They said, this guy's lost his touch. He used to be a great researcher, but not now.
Now he's whacked out, right?
Whacked out, yeah. He wears the tinfoil hat. So they took him off the job, and they assigned it to somebody else, and they came back with pretty much the same results. Well, they took him off the job, and the third time, it was also very positive. They finally took this whole research project out of Sloan Kettering and subcontracted it to another outfit in some laboratory that nobody ever heard of. And lo and behold, they got the negative results they were looking for. And that's what they finally published.
Huh.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, yeah, unbelievable. That's how it goes. And now the reason I mention that is because a couple of years later, I've forgotten the congressman's name, but through a Freedom of Information request, he obtained the board of directors minutes at Sloan Kettering from that period of time that talked about Leah Trill. And the quotation is in my book. It's just stunning. This is right from the Sloan Kettering board of directors. They said, we are not interested in studying Leah Trill, but we would be very interested in studying a substance that has the same chemical reaction as Leah Trill.
That's like saying Leah Trill.
That's like saying Leah Trill, yeah. And the reason, and there it was, once you understand the jargon, they were saying, we cannot patent Leah Trill because you cannot patent anything from nature. But if we can analyze the active ingredient in Leah Trill and produce it in a test tube, Now we can patent it, and that's what we're interested in.
That's the bottom line. We're going to come back, talk more with you, G. Edward Griffin, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie, G. Edward Griffin with us. Edward, let's talk a little bit about your documentary, if we can. And it's called Offline. Tell me about that. We've been talking about this for a long time.
Yeah, it's probably one of the most, I don't know what word to use. I was going to say fascinating, but it's more than fascinating. It's scary. It's frightening topics I have ever run across. And I know your listeners are familiar with the basic theme, but here's what I found. I didn't know anything about this a year and a half, 2 years ago. But then a young lady by the name of Petraea Patrick approached me, and she said, I'm producing a documentary film on solar flares. And I thought, well, that's good. I love to talk about solar flares. They're interesting things. Well, that's not what she was talking about. She was saying, no, these are killers, solar flares. And the idea was that we are in for some big solar flares that can cause havoc on this planet. And I was totally unbelieving at first. I thought, this doesn't make sense. Solar flares happen all the time. You read about them in the newspaper. You can see pictures of them. Who's worried about solar flares? Well, then I began to learn, George, and as I said before, your listeners are well aware of this, but what I found out is that not all solar flares are alike.
No, not at all.
Yeah. And that's what that was the missing piece in my education, that there's quite a variation in intensity and even composition. And every once in a while, there is a big killer solar flare that goes shooting out into space. And God help us if it ever hits the Earth. Some of them do hit the Earth, and the last one is called the Carrington event, a little 156 mm-hmm. years ago.
That's right.
And it hit the Earth, and it knocked out the telegraph system. And even that was kind of a little a pussycat solar flare compared to some of them that missed the Earth. I mean, the scientists, astronomers in particular, have recorded other solar flares that were 10,000 times stronger than the Carrington event.
And even though your documentary, Edward, primarily is about the solar flares, a rogue government detonating a nuke in our atmosphere would do the same thing.
Exactly, the same effect. It's the electromagnetic pulse that lands on the Earth and is picked up by the power lines. Back in, 156 years ago, whatever year that was, we didn't have the grid system that we have now. We had some telephone lines and some telegraph lines,
I should say. Yeah.
And they picked up enough voltage to burn the equipment and set fire to the telephone poles and burn down a couple of those telegraph shacks and everything. Well, that was nothing compared to the thousands and thousands of miles of wire that are strung around the planet
now. Oh, my God. What a disaster.
And that acts as an antenna, as you know.
We've got our documentary producer here with us. Yeah. Petraea Patrick is on the other line. Hey, Petraea, welcome to the show.
Yes, I would just say this could be one of the most devastating events that the United States could ever face. And I'm so glad you're bringing this subject matter up tonight.
We are attempting, Petraea, to get some Congress folks to pass legislation to protect our power grid. It's estimated to be about $2 billion to do the job. That's chump change compared to what they've wasted before. And it's estimated, as you probably know in your research on your documentary, that 90% of the Americans could be dead within a year if we lost the power grid. That's frightening.
Well, it is frightening, and I think most people are going to ask, well, how does that occur? What happens to the power grid? Why, if it went off, could we not just turn it back on? Well, these 17 major infrastructures that run our country, from sanitation to communications to food distribution to transportation, fuel, and medicine, they all run on electricity. And if the grid is hit from a solar storm, it would destroy the transformers. And how it destroys them is it melts them to a solid mass where they're incapacitated.
And we don't have enough to replace them all.
We don't make them here is the bad thing.
Well, that's
so you
right.
want to talk about needing jobs in our country and opening up a new industry. How about the transformer industry?
China makes a lot of them, I hear.
Yes, and it takes over 2 years to have them made and delivered. And I don't think we're on China's good chum list that they're going to put us at the front of the line, because they are already making these transformers and have quite a few orders, many, many orders, for other countries who are taking steps to protect their grid.
That's right. And some states are.
Why are we not doing that?
Well, that's the big question. That's the $64,000 question. What's going on? Why are they not doing the very simple task of spending the money to get the grid protected? Why do you think, and we'll bring Edward in on this too, why do you think they're not doing it at this point?
I would say the number one reason is liability. So far, they are a corporation, a set of corporations run through NERC, and as long as they say we're responsible for giving you pretty sure, safe power to your home accurately and accommodate you to get it there most of the time, and then we keep your prices fair, that's their responsibility. Once they step over the line and say we're going to fix an issue that they don't want to take responsibility for, then they have crossed that line to liability. And I've been to a lot of summits and hearings and conferences, listened to committees, and been all the way back east and spent a lot of time crossing the country, and that is the issue, is that they don't want to be liable.
Edward, your take on that. Why aren't they fixing it?
Well, I agree totally with what Petraea just said. It's liability at the corporate level. But at the political level, it seems to me like it's politics as usual. I think that the politicians don't want to really get involved, because then they'd have to admit that they're not doing anything. And there's one thing a politician does not want to say, is that he's failing to take care of a problem. And so they want to just create the image that everything is fine. We're holding these meetings. We've got these committees formed. We've got these seminars going on. We're drawing up these plans and these white papers, and we're working like crazy. Can't you see? Everything is fine. Go back to sleep. Leave us alone.
That is exactly right. And I would just follow up to say, if you look at some of the campaign contributions to some of these politicians who have stopped the former grid bills that have been very close to being passed, you look at their campaign contributions, and they are from some of these energy companies.
We may end up getting John McCain on board to get some serious legislation passed, and might need your help of getting him a copy of your documentary so he can visualize that. We've sent him books already from William Forstchen and Michael Maloof. Their works, but your documentary in the hands of Congress, both of you, would be, I think, great. You think we can do that?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Congressman Trent Franks is in it, and some quite heavy people, the former head of the EMP Commission, Dr. William Graham, who is the leader of saying it's not a matter of if, but when this solar storm will happen. And you mentioned $2 billion earlier just to fix it. Well, we are already being hit with over $2 billion. That's a very low sum. It could be as much as $12 billion a year. And that could just be in California. I'm trying to get the latest figures from one of the companies that we've been in contact with. And this $2 billion a year in damages already hitting the grid. And we get charged that through just different ways,
yeah,
through any electronics that we purchase and through sometimes in our bill. And so if we spent $2 billion to fix it, there ought to be some kind of kind courtesy where we would actually see our bills go down. But I don't think that would happen. And it really should, because once this problem is fixed, and what's beautiful about fixing the grid for solar storms is that you would be also fixing it for the EMPs from an enemy.
A rogue attacker, that's right.
Yes. So I think it's probably the number one national security issue right now. And up until I think it was 2008, this used to be pretty much classified information. And so really, it's time, you're starting to see now that more books are coming out about this information, and you've had Matt Stein on, When Technology mm-hmm. Fails. And that's the thing, is we, as citizens, we need to look at what we can do right now, because since no one's stepping forward, and I don't think they're going to, even if tomorrow something was to happen and they were ordered by the president to fix the grid, they would still lag their feet around.
Well, and it should be, Petraea, it should be a major presidential campaign. I mean, this should be splattered all over the debates.
Absolutely. I had listened to all the debates, and not one of the people standing up there has brought up this.
They just don't get it. They just don't get it.
And I'm surprised. Ted Cruz does know about this. He's been briefed by some of our people that are in the film.
Newt Gingrich was, when he at least was attempting to go for the White House several years ago, used it as one of his campaign plans. Of course, he didn't go anywhere, but at least he talked about it.
Yes,
and one of the things that sort of surprised me when Petraea was on the road and sending back reports from all of the interviews that she was getting, the thing that surprised me is that we thought in the beginning that it was our job to inform all these political figures and corporate figures of what's going on and what the danger was. And we discovered very quickly that they knew all about it. They'd been studying it for years, but they were trying to prevent the public from finding out about it. Now, that's scary when you think about
that.
And that is the major issue right now, is that we, as the public, are not protected. The White House is protected, Homeland Security, or the, you know, just the Pentagon, all these places are protected. But we, as people, aren't protected. And what's even worse is that we wouldn't know what to do. We know for earthquakes how to prepare, and if we have a snowstorm, we can take care of that. We know pretty much.
If the power goes out for a day, Petraea, the public goes crazy.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is when we're talking about this, it's very important to be clear that people say, well, oh, okay, yeah, we've had a brownout before, or we've had a blackout. We've even had a blackout for a few uncomfortable days. But this film and this issue is dealing with a total grid meltdown. And that's why it's so important that they understand if the transformers are fried, you can't bring them up again. And then we have to go somewhere and try to buy them. And how are you going to do that when you can't pick up the phone and communicate? And that is the sad fact, is that our food wouldn't be able to be delivered.
Your ATMs, you couldn't pump gasoline. People couldn't go anywhere.
And our water is all pumped. In California, it's all pumped down through the Colorado River or the California Aqueduct or through the state aqueduct.
And what do you think is worse, no air conditioning or no heating?
Actually, a lot of people can die from the heat. In Australia, they experience...
A lot of people could freeze to death.
And a lot of people can freeze to death. But I think what the worst would be is the water contamination would happen very quickly.
Yeah, and pipes would freeze if this was done in the dead of winter.
And so each community really could look at what they can do, because some people would face just more quickly going into starvation mode. Somebody like our state, like Washington, might have a little more water security because they get more rain, but they might have other issues. So if a community takes a look at this and sees what they need to do now and start looking at their community, what they can do, and take this seriously, because if the government even does take measures, they will drag their feet, and it'll be a long time. And
absolutely,
this, as Edward was saying, this could happen any time. We're way overdue for one, and you won't see these solar storms. They're not like lightning.
They just get it. It takes a couple days to get here.
It can take, like, we could see in 20 minutes that we have a notification from our satellites
that it's coming.
But that is coming. And we could pretty much tell if it's a good size one within that last.
But it doesn't travel at the speed of light. People think it does. It does not.
It goes fast enough. But the question is that if the power companies do say, okay, it's coming, and we all shut down, they're still not sure they can get up again.
That's right.
It's a very difficult process.
They'll get fried.
Well, it's safer to turn it off so you don't get fried, but then if you, let's say it was a smaller storm and it didn't get hit, or we turned it off so we wouldn't get fried, it's still a big deal to get it back on. They don't know how long it would take to bring the grid back up. So they don't want to do that, and they don't want to scare customers, and then the government doesn't want to scare the public, so they don't want us to be
Well, you'd think the power companies would do this just to protect their business, or the major internet companies that are based on using power. I mean, if the internet goes down because of the power grid, of course, everybody's up a creek. But you would think Facebook, Amazon.com, and all the heavy players on the internet who make billions would contribute to a $2 billion project and get this fixed.
I would think so. Just to put out the collection hat, and I think those entities right there would be able to afford this.
Oh, my God.
One of the things is that people don't want to stick their necks out and be in the front of the parade and look like they're alarmists when nobody else seems to be concerned about it.
And I do know, too, that when you were mentioning a little bit earlier, Ed, they come in and they tell the companies, okay, look, it's okay, and we've checked everything, and these people that are talking about solar storms and EMPs, it's ridiculous, like that's not going to happen. And I have sat down and talked with people and said, would you say that to the camera? And they won't. Matter of fact, very few of the people in the power industry will talk about this, and the people that are their spokespersons are very clever at making it sound like something's being done and the problems are being addressed, and they are very good at talking to Google and all of these Silicon Valley businesses that are the communications centers of our state. They keep them, I think, with false information.
Yeah, they do. How can people get this documentary, Petraea?
We have it on Ed's website.
Yeah, amazing. The timing was so perfect, George, that today was the day that we put up our website announcing the availability of this. Today's the day.
Everything's about timing, Ed.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah. So the place to go, of course, is realityzone.com.
Simple enough.
Right. When the minute they get there, they'll see the banner right there on the front page for offline.
All right, great. Well, Petraea, thank you for being on the program. I appreciate it.
Well, it was a pleasure, and I hope people will take action to protect themselves, their families, and their communities. And this is such an important thing for our country, and I think people need to do this just because they're Americans, and that's what we do as Americans, take care of our country
and our families. We better do that as well. And Ed, we're going to keep you to chat for a couple more hours and take some phone calls later. About all this, there's some still amazing stories coming down. You did a little work about Noah's Ark. That's fascinating for me, a little bit of geoengineering. And I must talk with you about nitric oxide. This is an incredible story, and I'm going to ask you if I'm right on something about nitric oxide, something I stumbled across a few years ago as well. And it seems to be amazing. Our special guest, G. Edward Griffin. All his works are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And he is one heck of a guy. And his websites, of course, are linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well. I'm George Norrie. We will be right back on Coast to Coast AM.